This show is sponsored by Index Funds Advisors at IFA.com. The rest of this show will run commercial free, and I want to thank Index Funds Advisors so very much for sponsoring this show, and please show them your gratitude by going out to IFA.com and consider signing up for an account with them to let them manage your financial future. Welcome to the Mad Money Machine. I'm your host, Paul Douglas Boyer. Our website is madmoneymachine.com, where you can subscribe, find other episodes, comment on this podcast, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. Our email address is feedback@madmoneymachine.com. Our voicemail line is 206-734-4763. We'd love to hear from you. My guest today is Russell Roberts, a professor of economics and the J. Fish and Lillian F. Smith Distinguished Scholar at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Welcome, Russ.
Great to be with you.
Of the 125,000 podcasts that Apple says are in iTunes, Econ Talk, which Russ hosts, is my favorite. Each week, Russ hosts a guest, and they talk about some interesting topics in economics. And I've got to say that Russ, of all hosts of any interview show that I've ever heard, asks the most intelligent questions that I have heard of any host ever. They can be long sometimes, but they have to be to capture all the content that's necessary. So in this show, and I talk to Russ, I want to find out a little bit more about Econ Talk, and I want to tell my listeners a little bit some of the things they might need to know when they listen to Econ Talk, and then part three of this, I'd like to solve the world's problems with economics. So, Russ, my listeners would like to get a chance to know more about you as the host of Econ Talk. So, first of all, how do you spend your time?
Well, I do a bunch of different things. I'm interested in, and I want to say thanks for your kind words. Appreciate them. I'm interested in trying to make economics and the economic way of thinking understandable to the normal human being as opposed to my fellow economists. And most people have a misperception of what economics is. They think of it as having to do with the stock market or the housing market or inflation. And of course, it's related to all those things. But economics, more than anything else, is how to get the most out of life, how to deal with the constraints and scarcities that every human being faces throughout history. No matter what our incomes are, we have to make choices. And then how those choices, when made by a bunch of people, turn into something that economists call a market. That's not a very useful phrase, unfortunately, because it conjures up images of other things. But how prices get determined and then how those in turn bounce back and affect our choices. That's what I'm interested in. To do that, I try to do a bunch of different things. I blog at Cafe Hayek with my colleague Don Boudreau. I write novels on economic principles to help people understand them in a pleasant way. And for the last year and a bit, I've been doing these podcasts every week at Econ Talk. And so when you ask me how I spend my time, I do all those things sort of, can't say I do them simultaneously. I'm not doing anything other than talking to you, but I try to do a little of all those things every week to push forward the ideas of economics to a more general audience.
How did you get started in economics?
Well, I was pretty good at it in high school, which was strange that we had a high school economics class, because at that time, this is back in the 70s, it wasn't common. But I enjoyed it, and I thought it's something I was going to take in college. And
it wasn't home economics, right?
What?
It wasn't home economics class.
No, but it was. It had some of the pluses and minuses of today's high school economics classes. There was I thought too big an emphasis on picking stocks as a way of keeping students interested, and not enough of what I think is the rest of economics. So there was a little of that too, and that's what got me interested. And then I enjoyed it in college. I was pretty good at it, so I thought, well, I'm going to do this some more of it. And then I realized I really liked it, and went on to graduate school, and had a fairly standard career to start with in economics, but then got interested in a more peculiar set of ideas, which are these novels I write, and sort of went off the beaten track to a little more unusual path for getting economics across to everyday people. And the internet's helped, obviously. The opportunity to blog and to do podcasts is just an extraordinary change in I think, the opportunities for everybody out there to learn about things they don't know about. And economics is just one of those things. I think we live in an incredible time. One, we have the wealth to enjoy these things, and two, they're out there, and people are producing all this material, often at little or no cost to the listener, and just at least out of pocket, and it's just an extraordinary opportunity to build your brain.
It absolutely is, and I have to agree when you talk about getting economics to the masses. Personally, I'm in the same boat. I didn't realize how much I enjoyed economics until I listened to your podcast. I used to think economics was all about the Federal Reserve Board,
right,
and like you say, interest rates and banking regulation, and yuck.
Right,
who
that's
wants that?
Pretty boring to me, although there are people who find it interesting. It's a small group, let's be honest. A larger group finds the rest of economics interesting, which is really the whole field of human behavior, both at the micro level of how people make decisions, and then I'm going to call it the macro level, but usually when we say macro, we mean things like the interest rate or inflation or the Fed. But another way to think about macro is aggregated decisions, how you and I, when we buy or sell our houses or the things that we enjoy day to day, how those interactions add up into what we call a market, where prices are determined and our transactions all affect one another. That's an incredibly subtle thing that the study of economics helps you appreciate, and there really is no other place you can learn that.
All right, before we get too deep into it, I'd like to understand the economics of Econ Talk itself.
Uh-huh.
Why did you start it? How long will it continue? Whose time are you on when you're doing it? And do you do face-to-face interviews mostly?
Well, I'll start with the last question first. I do a mix of interviews. Some of them are face-to-face. Sometimes they're with my colleagues here at George Mason. I spend part of my summer usually at Stanford at the Hoover Institution, and I interview people out at Stanford face-to-face. But most of my interviews are done over the phone, as this one is, with a set of equipment that help makes it fairly pleasant for the listener to hear without static and other interferences you hear on a normal phone call. In terms of who sponsors it and whether it will continue, it's part of a project called the Library of Economics and Liberty, which is a website, EconLib, E-C-O-N-L-I-B, the Library of Economics and Liberty, econlib.org, which is a project of Liberty Fund. Liberty Fund's a foundation out of Indiana that's interested in spreading knowledge, broadly defined, and they do a bunch of things. They publish a lot of wonderful books, classics in economics and political theory and law. And they also host this website and another website called the Online Library of Liberty. And those are resources that, to go back to EconLib, the Library of Economics and Liberty, the one I'm involved with, these are resources for people around the world to learn more about economics and liberty. So we have a bunch of classic works online. We have Adam Smith and David Ricardo and Marshall and other classic economists and some modern ones like my Nobel Prize-winning colleague James Buchanan. We have an encyclopedia, the Concise Encyclopedia of Economics, edited by David Henderson, that we're about to update. It's going to be an incredible resource. Even the older one, which we have up there now, is really useful, but the new one's going to be even better. We have a blog, EconLog, and then we have the podcast, and we have monthly essays on various topics, and then we have the podcast series, Econ Talk. So my view is, in terms of whether it will continue, the Library of Economics and Liberty is supports it, and as long as people listen, I'm going to do it for a while. To me, and I'm sure it's the same with you. Every week I can walk into a lecture hall with thousands of people, which is what Econ Talk has. I mean, I'm going to get up and talk to them. As long as I'm interested in stay interested in economics, I'm going to keep talking. So. It's been a great experience for me. I don't know what it's like for you, but I have learned a great deal from my guests and from the books that I've read of my guests and their ideas. It's incredibly stimulating.
It is wonderful. It's a fantastic resource. I hope you do continue it. Let's tell people again how to get it. I think there's four ways you can get it. Go to econtalk.org. That's probably the primary website for it, right?
And we have up there with each podcast, we have extra additional readings and highlights of the podcast so that you can go back and listen to parts of it if you want that you can figure out where the ideas were. So yeah, that's our webpage, and you can comment there on the podcast. But you can also go to iTunes.
Right. Search for Econ Talk, or you can go into the podcast section under Higher Education, as I understand it, is the category.
That's where we put it.
Not under business.
And other ways to get it, I think there are other podcast aggregators that, collect stuff. I think there are many of those, so any of those work.
You've mentioned your books. Let's move on.
Sure.
You have written a book called The Choice, A Fable of Free Trade and Protection. You've written a book, which I've read, called The Invisible Heart, An Economic Romance.
Yep.
And you mentioned you've got another, I think you've got another book that you're working on coming out. I'd like to read The Choice at some point. I guess I've got to...
Make sure you read the there have been three editions. I wrote the first one in the early 90s. So the book's about trade issues, and it's a primer on trade written in the form of a novel. It's a dialogue mostly between two characters, one, Ed Johnson, a fictional but based on reality person in Illinois who runs a television factory in the 60s who's worried about Japanese competition. And wants protection from Japanese competition, and he gets involved in a conversation with David Ricardo's ghost. David Ricardo's the person who really created what we might call modern international economics, though he did in the early 1800s, but he was the person who came up with this idea that trade makes both parties better off, even when one party is better at everything than the other party. Strangely enough, they can both benefit from trade. And so they get into a long conversation about trade policy and all the different aspects of trade. And by reading that book, you learn about most of the issues in trade policy today. But when I wrote the book in the early 90s, Japan was the thing that most Americans were worried about. So the book had a heavy, the first edition has a heavy focus on why we shouldn't be afraid of Japan. And despite all the people who told us that they were going to take over America and ruin our economy, I think those folks were proven wrong. Then I revised the book in the around 2000, and the big issue by then was NAFTA and all the problems we were going to have because Mexico was going to steal all our jobs and ruin our economy. So I de-emphasized Japan to a large extent and emphasized NAFTA and other trade issues like the World Trade Organization that were supposedly going to destroy our sovereignty. And when I updated it one more time a year or so ago, all of a sudden those issues weren't on the table anymore and people weren't worried about those. Now people were worried about outsourcing in China. So the current edition, besides tightening the writing and making it a little bit more interesting to read, I've de-emphasized NAFTA, I de-emphasized Japan, and now I put more of a focus on the issues that are in the news and people's minds and concerns now, which are China, India, outsourcing, the loss of manufacturing jobs, and whether these are going to destroy our economy. And the answer, I think, is still no. We still have a very vibrant, dynamic, and good economy for almost everybody who wants to participate in it. It's not a wonderful world for every single person. Trade has ups and downs for different people, but over time, and even at a point in time, trade is overwhelmingly beneficial for most, if not all, Americans. So,
sounds like a very dynamic book. I wonder what the fourth edition will bring.
Yeah, I hope there isn't one. I have a fantasy that people will just one day realize that we don't have to be afraid of foreign countries and foreign trade, but that's a fantasy, I'm afraid. But but if you do look for it and get the third edition, it's actually cheaper than the last edition, too. Some people still buy the second edition. I don't know why. It's $26. Maybe they think that the more you pay, the better it is. But the third edition's only $20. You can get used copies at Amazon. Feel free to get a used copy if you want to save a few bucks.
Yeah. You've talked about that on your show before, the used book market and libraries, and don't they hurt authors? Interesting. So you don't care about going to the library to read
your book. To the library, buy one of my books, give it away, lend it to friends. I don't live off of my royalties. Most authors don't. They're not big enough to live off of. But my main goal in writing those books is to spread good economics, and I'd like more and more people to read them. So that'd be great.
You have a new book coming out. You've asked people on your website to vote for their favorite title of the book. Have you picked one, and when's it coming out?
Well, we're still discussing that, but we're leaning toward one of the titles that was popular, which is The Price of Everything. A lot of people like that title. It's got problems, but every title has problems. Usually, you've read The Invisible Heart, a lot, that book, and to some extent the new book is really what I'm interested, you could call it what I've been interested in for the last few years. That's not a very good selling title, but it has a lot of different ideas in it. They do tie together, but it's hard to grasp it, you know, put it in one title. So if I called the book The Economics of Prices, that would be a snoozer. And although the book is somewhat about prices, what it's really about is how the modern economy that we are fortunate enough to have in the United States allows us to plan and dream and fulfill our desires of a wide variety of stuff, both material and non-material, in ways that don't require a central planner. And that somehow my dreams and your plans somehow interact in ways that don't lead to chaos and disorder, but rather smoothly get interwoven. And that's what the book's about. As a result, I talk a lot about America's standard of living, how it's been created, and why we have such a successful economy, which is, to me, one of the most important issues and lessons for particularly students, but for every American. And it's strange that we live in the wealthiest, most successful economic system in history, and most of us don't understand why it works the way it does.
Right.
So the book really tries to peel back the veil of what's going on, and so that people can really see how it is that a modern economy like ours is so successful. We totally take it for granted. That's a mistake. We think it's sort of like a machine that just kind of choo-choos along like some kind of little train, and it's that's not the right metaphor. It's not a train, and it doesn't have its own momentum. It's fragile to some extent if it's tampered with in the wrong way, and I think it's important that people understand it. Having said that, it is a tremendous organic thing that is hard to ruin because it has so much in power. So when we do tamper with it, a lot of times just the economy just kind of weaves its way around the barriers and keeps going. So I almost called the book A Stone in the River because to some extent some things, that some regulations are just a stone in the river. The water just swishes around them and nothing happens. But other regulations cause the water to spill off into places you don't want it to go, the law of unintended consequences. So all those issues come up in the book, and I hope people like it.
Can't wait to get a copy of that.
And it's a novel also. It'll come out next year. Princeton University Press will be publishing it. And
it's fascinating that someone can turn information like that into a novel, I think. It's just amazing.
Well, I think people like it. It's although people now have an increasing taste for dry books, nonfiction books, I think it is the golden age of economics publishing. So many books have come out in the last few years with economic themes that would never have been written 10, 20 years ago. So
any of them you like?
I like them all somewhat, yeah.
Anyone in particular?
Well, a lot of them are written for people who have no economics background.
Okay.
And so they're trying to do what I do. They're trying to teach people the economic way of thinking. Steve Landsberg's written a number of interesting books. Tim Harford's book, The Undercover Economist, Robert Frank's book, The Economic Naturalist. I'm going to talk to him soon on Econ Talk.
Yeah, you've mentioned actually many authors on your show, and I've got to say that they've sold books because I've gone out and bought many of the books that you've
mentioned. Well, I'm happy to hear that.
On your show. And I'm looking forward to getting the one that you did recently. I'm not going to be able to recall the name of it, but it was about the dentist and the economics.
Oh, that's by my colleague Tyler Cowen. It's called Discover Your Inner Economist.
That's the one.
And that's a very offbeat look at human behavior from an economist's perspective, but it mixes in a lot of psychology, and Tyler's a very, very widely read person. So that is a different book in a way than what we're talking about. You know, there are other books that have economics at their theme, Freakonomics, Freedomnomics. Mm-hmm. They're not trying, they use economics, but they're not trying to teach you the basics. Thomas Sowell's Basic Economics would be another example of a book that's written just to help people try to understand what economists understand about the world. And that's it's an amazing time for that kind of book. You know, it used to be there was one book you could recommend, which would be a book like Milton Friedman's Capitalism and Freedom or Free to Choose, which are about, you know, the interface between economic thinking and public policy. There are just so many now. And we're a wealthier country, and I think there's more interest in it.
Well, I did want to talk about the economics of content and information and media. When I grew up, we had three TV channels. We had to go to a theater to see movies. There were no video games and certainly no podcasts. Today, it's crazy, the amount of media that just keeps flowing into us. Where are we headed with all this stuff? How can we absorb the right things?
Well, you know, there was... people oscillate between thinking that the whole thing is going to be totally wide open. There'll be no gatekeepers, no filters. You'll just wander around this great sea of information, a sea of music, a sea of entertainment. But there's so much of it, we're always going to look for people and institutions to help us make our choices. We'll voluntarily choose which ones work the best for us. We do that when we buy a book that's published by a publisher rather than it's self-published, because we assume, usually correctly, that the books that are published by a publisher are more interesting or more entertaining or more informative. Although, you know, it's amazing how many great books publishers reject, and there are many self-published books, I'm sure, that are worthwhile. The same is true of music. We read reviews, we rely on record companies to screen entertainers, and yet there's an immense amount of really wonderful music that isn't that's produced, that isn't vetted or reviewed or screened by those folks. So I think there's always going to be a tension between choosing from a wide, wide array versus we don't have an infinite amount of time. We're going to look for ways to find stuff that we're going to more likely to like.
Well, I hope that I can be the gatekeeper for my listeners and point them to your podcast as something of interest.
Well, it's the same. That's the kind of role we're talking about. What's amazing is how markets respond, how institutions respond. So you have something like Amazon, which does an amazing job not just providing books at low cost that are easy to search for and find, but can make recommendations of what you might like, and iTunes does that as well. So that's a non-centralized, self-organizing, really, way that you get new ideas for what to enjoy. So this is an incredible time. I think it's amazing that as recently as 5 years ago, people were complaining that a handful of media giants were dominating the world. Disney, for example, was viewed as this great monster. And there has never been a time in human history where the everyday average person had more access to information, to entertainment, to news. It's just, it's a glorious time to be a curious person.
It really absolutely.
And as you point out, when I was, I'm 50, I'll be 53 in a few days. When I was growing up, you had the three channels and then PBS. There was four.
It was on that weird channel where you had to turn the dial.
And you had that sometimes. Yeah. It might get one more channel. And it's not just that you only had four or five channels or three to choose from. They were real similar.
Yeah.
It wasn't just that there were only three or four. It's that they weren't very diverse. They were in a pretty uncompetitive world, and the safest thing for them was to try to be like each other. And now we live in a world where you have such an incredible profusion of choices. I think it's just beginning, by the way. I think we barely tapped into it. But you think about the profusion of choices, just simple things, sports, food, history, the arts, the stuff that's available, movies, the stuff that's available just on TV. And when broadband gets growing even better, I mean, just you look at stuff like the iPhone and how information is going to come into our lives in different ways in the next, you know, 5-10 years. It's going to be remarkable. It's going to be even better. It's hard to believe. It's going to get even better. As great as it is now, we'll get better.
You've mentioned on your podcast that you have three kids, age 7 to 14, if I'm correct.
I have four, actually.
Four kids. I got that wrong. Okay.
That's all right.
And that you don't teach them PowerPoint at the age of four.
Right.
You teach them reading instead. You model reading behavior. And that, I think you've also mentioned that you like to play board games.
I do.
With them. What are some of your favorites?
Well, I just want to emphasize the first point you made, which is a lot of parents, I think, are overly obsessed with their kids getting computer skills. And maybe that's softened a little bit over the last few years. But when my kids first started going to school, again, the oldest is 14, people would say, you know, does she know how to use the computer? And knowing how to use a computer has gotten, first of all, it's gotten easier and easier. And my kids use computers better than I do in many dimensions. A lot of our kids do on the world. There's nothing that hard about it. And by the time they grow up again, it's going to be, I think, even easier to use them. So the idea of wasting time when kids have this extraordinary brain capacity and curiosity, teaching them the mechanics of how to use a mouse or how to use a spreadsheet or how to use PowerPoint seems to me a terrible use of children's time. Yes, when you grow up, it's good to know how to use a spreadsheet. It's something that you can learn in about a half an hour when you're 18 years old. You can learn it in a week if you really want to be superb at it. So to spend the crucial time of maturing brains on that kind of stuff to me is a terrible decision. And PowerPoint, I don't think it's very good for adults. so I think it's really bad for kids. It leads to a very stultified, I think, and stagnant way of presenting a material that's not very helpful. And I'm a big fan of Edward Tufte, who rails against it, and I think he's right. Mm-hmm. But going to the question of board games, I think it's nice to interact with our kids in various ways, and we're always looking for ways to do stuff with them rather than, say, planting them in front of a computer or television. So we play a lot of sports with our kids, physical games, and then in the more mental side of games, we particularly like Settlers of Catan, which is a trading game, has some good economics in it. Basically, to succeed in that game, you have to rely on the other players. It's unlike life, it's not really, it is competitive. Life is competitive also, but not in the way the board games are. It's a little bit confusing to me for our kids. You have to make it clear that in the real game of life, everybody can win. In these board games, often there's one winner and then everyone else is a loser. Okay. But of course, in life, you can, Bill Gates isn't the winner. We're all winners. We all, and to the extent we all enjoy his computer, or in my case, Steve Jobs' brainchild, the Apple stuff. We're not losing because we're enjoying their stuff. So the Settlers of Catan is a nice game. There's trading, and it's complex and fun to play. And our seven-year-old almost won this last time we played. So you can play with a fairly young group.
Right.
The other game we really like is a game called Puerto Rico, which is also an economic development game.
It's sort of right here on my list in that order, Settlers of Catan and Puerto Rico, to ask you about. That's amazing.
Yeah, so I love both of those. But we play other stuff. We play some various card games that have strategic sides to them, some more complex than others. We play a little bit of chess. And we play we do lots of just family stuff, conversations, and we read stories to them, and we read poetry to them, and we sing to them, and sing together, and it's just great, I think, for families to do those things. I think it makes for good families, and I think it makes for good adults, I hope. We'll find out.
Let's turn now to the second part, and that is what someone might need to know when they listen to Econ Talk. You've mentioned that when you go to parties, people ask you, so what do you do? And you say, I'm an economist. And they say, so where do you think the stock market is headed? What is your strategy for navigating parties these days?
I'm getting better at that. I've tried a couple different strategies. I've talked about that occasionally at Cafe Hayek on my blog. If I say to people, when they ask me what I do, if I say I write economics novels or novels about economics, sometimes I used to think that people go, wow, that's different. That's interesting. What would those be like? No one says that. They kind of clam up and get scared, and they think I must be some, crazy academic. Maybe I am, but I really did write that. I want to say, no, they're written for you. A lot of people assume if it's got the word economics in it, it must be mathematical or really, you have to be a genius or have taken graduate work in economics to understand it. That's a huge battle I face. So I don't have a good party strategy really right these days. I just hope eventually people find out about these things. But I think it's an interesting challenge.
Go ahead. If you go back and listen to several of the archived shows on Econ Talk, which I highly recommend doing, and it's beautiful that they don't just fall off like TV shows used to do, and you could never catch up with them, that you can go back and get them. But three things that have all come up time and time again on the shows are Hayek, Wikipedia, and libertarianism. And I need to find out more about Hayek and libertarianism. I know all about Wikipedia. So who is Hayek, and why do you keep mentioning him on your show?
Well, Hayek first let me say that the shows vary in how the level of difficulty of them. Some of them are fairly sophisticated, require some background in economics. I'm trying to talk about to a Nobel Prize winner about his work. It can be talked about at a simple level, but sometimes we might accidentally take for granted some ideas that our listeners might not fully understand. So some are a little more sophisticated, but a lot of them are very basic, and we're doing basic economic education when we do those. An example would be the one we did on buying local, whether it's economically a good idea to buy local. But going to the general question, some of these themes that come up now and then, Hayek was an economist who spanned a good chunk of the 20th century. He's what's known as an Austrian economist. He started off his career in Austria, eventually came to London and then to England and then to the United States. And his central idea that comes up a lot in the show is the idea of self-organizing systems, or the way that markets coordinate knowledge via prices. And that's a subtle idea. A lot of my next book is about that, to try to make it easier for people to understand. But any time that issue comes up, I want to try to remind people about it, because I think it's an unappreciated and mostly unknown idea, this idea that there are things out in the world that are the product of human action but not human design. They look like they're designed by someone. They have a regularity and a predictability about them. So one example I use in The Invisible Heart is tomorrow here in the Washington, D.C. area, there are going to be plenty of bagels and plenty of coffee, but there's no coffees are, there's no bagels are, there's nobody who makes sure that there's plenty. And yet if you wake up tomorrow and decide to throw a brunch and order a bunch of coffee and bagels and show up at your local corner store, they're not going to say, what? You didn't call ahead. We're out. They're never out. So how can that be? How can it be that one other example I like is on Super Bowl Sunday, which is one of the top two or three, if not the most popular pizza days of the year, if you want a croissant or something that's not pizza, that's uses flour, you show up and they don't say to you, what are you kidding? We don't have any croissants. This is the busiest pizza day of the year. All the flour went to make pizza. Of course you can't get anything else, but it's not true. You can get anything you want on Super Bowl Sunday that uses flour. There's plenty of cookies and scones and bagels and other things that use flour. So how is it that the plans and actions of all these different people can integrate with each other and yet not cause shortages and disorder and chaos? Again, we take that for granted. And Hayek was very interested in how prices steer and send signals to entrepreneurs that steer resources to highly valued uses and yet don't leave everyone else out in the lurch. And so that theme comes up from time to time. These self-organizing systems without a coordinator still look as if they're coordinated. And to me, much of the most interesting thing that economics has to say about the world is in understanding that, because it's not intuitive. It's not common sense. It's very unintuitive. That's one thing. The second thing you mentioned is Wikipedia, which is related to that, right? Wikipedia is a decentralized, chaotic, seemingly disorganized system that actually works strikingly well, magnificently well, in providing information. And the third example you gave is libertarianism. We talk a lot on the show about the role of freedom, and that's also related to the first part. Hayek was interested in how, among other things, he was interested in how when you leave things alone, sometimes they turn out pretty well, and that's not intuitive. So those themes run through the shows to some extent. Sometimes they don't come up, but they often come up. I just think those are things that I'm, you know, it's just my own personal interest. The show, to some extent, is what interests me, the books and ideas that interest me. And if that's of interest to other people, the show will be successful. And if it's not, we're in trouble.
Well, I'm glad it is of interest to you, because it's wonderful and brilliant, of highly interest to me as well. I love what Hayek is talking about there. You mentioned, I think he's talking about spontaneous order.
Mm-hmm. That's
often used. Now, my show, of course, is about investing, and if Hayek were a financial planner, I get the feeling that he, too, would recommend index funds.
Yeah, well, that's to me, when people ask me about the stock market, I always say economics has very little to say about the stock market, contrary to what most people think. But one of the things you learn from the study of economics is the virtue of index funds, which is related to the idea that the way I like to tell it is, you know, two people are walking down the street, one's an economist, and the non-economist says, oh, look, a $20 bill. And the economist says, no, don't bother picking it up. If it were really there, someone would have picked it up already. And of course, sometimes you're the first person to pick up the $20 bill, in which case you can grab it. Yeah. A lot of times, though, those $20 bills that seem to be lying on the sidewalk are an illusion, and there's a cost to acquiring them that you don't anticipate. And so, as an investor, personally, my general strategy is overwhelmingly index funds, because I assume that it's very difficult for an individual stock picker, someone who's managing a mutual fund or a broker who's giving me stock tips, is going to have trouble finding a $20 bill that someone else hasn't found already, an insight or a market opportunity that isn't there already. So that's the economic argument for index funds, is that gains, what we might call unexploited gains, get exploited. You can be the first one, but yeah, the odds are small that you're the first one. So when someone, a buddy, says to you, gosh, I got a great stock tip, as an economist, my first question always is, are you the first person to get it? Because if you're not, the market price already reflects that information, and you're unlikely to do better than you would otherwise. And the virtue of mutual of index funds is that the transaction costs of moving in and out of them, because of the way they're designed, are relatively small. So actively traded mutual funds or individual stock choices have to really do better, because they have to overcome those transaction costs.
Right.
And that's a very Hayekian idea, as you point out.
So do all good economists end up as libertarians?
No. And we did a podcast a few weeks ago about why economists disagree. There are a lot of good economists who are not libertarians, who are much more eager to let the government tweak or tamper with or steer the economy than I would be willing to see. Although there are a lot of great market-oriented libertarian economists, people like Milton Friedman or Hayek or von Mises. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of fine economists who have a different political flavor, a different political taste. In the blogosphere, you know, Brad DeLong has a very nice blog. He's on the other side of the political fence from me, although maybe not so far. But there are a lot of good economists who are more willing to see government intervention.
Let's turn now to solving the world's problems with economics.
Piece of cake.
I'll start with an easy question, and that is, if Radio Shack sells a branded battery tester, would an economist trust it?
What do you mean?
Radio Shack sells batteries. Would you buy a battery tester from Radio Shack?
And what would be my worry?
The concern there is that even though the battery still has some life left in it, it's in Radio Shack's best interest for that battery tester to show that, no, there's not really much life left in this battery, so we're going to try to sell more batteries this way.
Well,
it's a matter of incentives in that.
Yeah, the problem with that, there's a general set of worries that people have that turn out not to be true, that are along those lines. You know, I used to hear from my students that, you know, the toothpaste, they make it really hard to get the last bit of the toothpaste out so that you'll buy more toothpaste. What people forget when they say that is that if you could figure out a way to get all the toothpaste out, you could sell it for more. True. If you couldn't change the price, it wouldn't be worth it to try to figure out that different method. But given that you can change the price, it's in the toothpaste maker's interest to not to throw away toothpaste. That's money that could be received from the consumer for something of value. So, and of course, we now have toothpaste dispensers that get out more of it, but they're a little more complicated to make. And eventually, I suspect they'll replace the traditional tube. But my explanation for why the tube existed before, why we still have them, is that they're relatively inexpensive. Even though you can't get the last little bit out, the cost of getting the last little bit out, it just isn't worth it for consumers. They had to bear that cost.
For me, so, it's mustard that's the hardest to get the last drop out.
Same issue with ketchup, right? Right. Those are all. You could have a conspiratorial worldview that says that's a way that we get exploited, but I think it's the opposite. I think consumers generally do very well and get helped by those kind of products. That what appears to be sometimes a source of consumer exploitation is just a cost that's not easily seen. But if we go back to the battery tester, if Radio Shack were the only seller of batteries and the only seller of battery testers, we might be worried about it. But given that they have to compete with lots and lots and lots of other suppliers, it's actually in their interest to have an honest battery tester, because if they lose their reputation for serving consumers and customers, people are going to stop going there. So competition is an extraordinary way that in a market economy, consumers get protected from the greedy incentives that you mentioned. Those incentives are there, and they get turned around by the competition. It's, you know, the obvious,
yes.
If you want to make money, you think the obvious way to make money is to sell a really crummy product at a really high price with really badly paid, made by really low-paid workers. That model doesn't work very well because there's competition. There were no competition, as there was, say, in the Soviet Union or in many countries today that aren't socialist but have less competition in their retail sectors. Well, yeah, people would have an incentive to do badly, treat people badly. But when there's competition, when there's more than one place to work, more than one place to shop, when there's dozens of places to work and shop, companies thrive by treating people well, not by harming them.
Let's turn to a little broader discussion. On yesterday's Econ Talk about property rights with Richard mm-hmm. Epstein, you guys talked about the freedom of landowners, and he was discussing how a person was free to use their land as they saw fit, as long as it didn't disturb their neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you generalize that statement, though, doesn't it apply as sort of a universal truth to say you're free to do as you please as long as you don't disturb your neighbor? Would you consider that to be sort of a basic code of civilization, a component of the equation of human happiness?
I do, and I think you're right. It does generalize. And Leonard Reed, the founder of the Foundation of Economic Education, wrote a very nice book called, I think it's called Anything That's Peaceful, where his general point was, if you do something that's peaceful, it's good, meaning if you don't harm other people by what you want to do, you pursue your own desires, but in ways that don't interfere with other people, then it's great. I think the interesting case that we struggle with in America is a couple of issues. One is we sometimes have a paternalistic urge, which is we worry that what people think is in their own self-interest may not be. And of course, sometimes it isn't, but that doesn't justify us intervening in their lives often, in my opinion, because mm-hmm. the incentives that are created when we say, oh, I can do what's in your own, in your interest, the power that's involved there is going to start to corrupt that seemingly good desire of paternalism. So I'm very skeptical of government regulation based on paternalism.
Right. And you guys talked to, well, go ahead.
The other issue I think that people struggle with is, so let's talk about the example I like to use with students and friends is this one. Well, let's suppose I subscribe to a magazine that you find distasteful. So we understand that if I dump my garbage in your backyard, that harms you. If I set off fireworks in my backyard to keep you up at night, that harms you. If I set off fireworks that set your house on fire, that harms you. Those are obvious examples where my actions cause harm to you. But let's talk about psychological harm, where a lot of people are, I think, willing to go, and I'm not. So in the case of psychological harm, I subscribe to a magazine you find offensive. You don't see the magazine, but you know I subscribe to it. Or I might paint my house a color that you find ugly. So it causes you psychological, aesthetic discomfort. So in the case of the magazine, it might be because of its you consider it vulgar. Or you might consider it the opposite of vulgar. You might consider it religious, and that might bother you. So we could imagine any type of person offended by any type of magazine that a neighbor might receive. So the question is, there is a case in that situation for allowing you to interfere with my magazine choice. You could argue that, well, if my magazine subscription harms you in that way, just because it's psychological doesn't mean it's not real. And unfortunately, so some people would make that argument. I think that is the road to tyranny. It's the road to a very dangerous world because although you can make the case, I think it's a dangerous case. It leads to government control of all kinds of things. And then the question would be, well, who decides what you're allowed to read? And in those countries where people start intervening in what people are allowed to read, freedom of all other kinds often gets reduced. So that principle of being tolerant of other people's choices, what they eat, right? We're starting to get intolerant of what people eat.
Mm.
We don't like that people smoke. We don't like that people eat meat. We don't like that people eat fat. We don't like that people eat candy, too many calories. and we start to justify, we have a justification for it. We say, well, see, when they do these things, that starts to affect my tax burden, and therefore I'm justified in intervening. And I think that argument is a very, it has a logic to it, which I respect. But the logic leads to the consequences of opening that Pandora's box of, if anything you do affects me at all, I have the right to interfere with you, then there's no rule left for what I'm allowed to do on my own. I would rather go the other direction and say, as long as I don't do physical violence to you or destroy things of value to you, such as dumping garbage and lowering the value of your house, then I'm entitled to do it. And I'd like to see us go more in that direction. I think that's the road towards human opportunity, human expression, and freedom. And I think that's the right way to go.
I would too. And I'm wondering if you're optimistic that as a society, as a world population of people who are becoming more intelligent because of the expanding tentacles of the internet, that you think that people will become enlightened? Will there be a new age of enlightenment where we understand these economics? Will it be religion or something that helps people to minimize the need for a complex legal code for everybody to get along? Or are you optimistic?
Well, I'm an optimist. One thing, if you look at the last 100 years, which is a good thing to look at. There's a tendency to look at yesterday or tomorrow. You know, say, well, boy, this political choices available to us this year don't look so appetizing, no matter where you are on the political spectrum. I think most people are a little bit discouraged. So, you know, if you do that, you know, this year's healthcare plan, whether it comes from Democrats or Republicans, they don't really excite me very much. I don't see a lot of reasons for optimism. So I take a longer view, though. I think that's the wrong. Looking any one year, you can always get discouraged or excited. But if you take the longer view, you see a march toward human freedom, a march toward tremendous economic improvement. And I think the long-run perspective of both looking back in history and seeing where we were in 1900 versus today makes me optimistic that in 2100 things will be better. I'm sure there are going to be some ups and downs, just like there were in the 20th century. We had horrible wars. We had horrible totalitarian evil from the Nazis and the communists. And I'm sure there'll be some challenges in the next 100 years that are going to be of similar magnitude because people are always flawed. But having said that, we've done, I think, a pretty good job moving in the right direction. I wouldn't say we've made no progress. Human progress, material progress has been a tremendous change. The number of people living under desperate poverty is going down. And I think in terms of political freedom, the freedom for human beings to express themselves and enjoy the fruits of their labor, that's improved as well. Still not, you could say the glass is half empty or half full, but as an optimist, I think it's more than half empty. I mean, half full, excuse me. So I'm optimistic.
The glass is twice as big as it needs to be.
But having said that, you know, the political system we operate under has some inherent institutional barriers to freedom. There's not as much political competition as I'd like, and the political system, political parties, it's in their incentive to reduce competition, and they try to do so. But I'm optimistic partly because, as you point out, I think as we understand these processes better, and I recommend my colleague, Brian Kaplan, who I did a podcast with on his book, I recommend that book, The Myth of the Rational Voter, a phenomenal book on how the political process works and how economics can be misunderstood. I think as we start to understand those things, it's going to help. I'm not going to say it's going to get perfect or my ideal society or yours is likely to happen. It's not. But I think we can stay away from the really bad decisions, and I think we've done that.
I'm eager and anxious for that future to happen. I know. I think as the MySpace generation grows up and gets into decision-making endeavors and positions, that there will be a change as to how things are run. Now, you've mentioned the people are objecting to what other people eat. Mm-hmm. And as another person that's in middle age, I've discovered there is a calorie economy, meaning that if I eat too many, bad things happen.
Yeah.
And if I don't exercise enough, bad things happen. On your show, Econ Talk, you have interviewed people from diverse subject matters. For example, you talked with an expert on ant behavior.
Yep.
I recommend that you talk with an expert on nutrition at some point to figure out how we can, why are we getting so fat in the United States, and will it ever be corrected?
Well, I do have a podcast on obesity.
Is that
you
right?
Have to go back in the archives to Darius Lakdawalla, who's an expert on this. The obesity thing is an interesting problem. I think, I mean, there's much more discussed than we talked about in that podcast, but most economists who've looked at it argue that the reason we're fat is that food's cheap. And food's got increasingly cheap, both domestically produced food, food produced in the home, and food produced in restaurants. So we've gotten better and better at the technology of it. So food's very inexpensive. And when things get less expensive, we tend to consume more of them.
But there's another saying that if you want less of something, tax it.
Correct.
So should we tax food? Should we tax rice and beans and potatoes and all that sort of stuff?
High carb stuff. High fat stuff. No, I think it's best to leave it alone for all kinds of reasons. One of which is, I have a deep belief in the importance of saving the world via ourselves rather than others. Yeah. So, if you remember the Invisible Heart, I think the world would be a better place if people watched less television.
Okay.
But I think a lot of people wish they watched less television. If you've ever as I used to do, I don't do it anymore, but I used to sit in front of the TV on a Sunday and watch 7 hours of football, and now you can watch 10.
Right, and you find yourself at the end of that saying, what in the world have I done all day?
What have I done? Now, sometimes it's a great day. Sometimes the games are exciting, and your team is one of the teams, or you have a couple teams, and they do well, and it's really fun, and you have friends over, and that's fine. But I'm talking about just sort of the vegging out phenomenon that sometimes just feels like the right thing to do, and then when it's done, you have regret. So that's a human problem in all kinds of areas. That's true when you have the second bowl of ice cream. It's true when you watch TV. There are a lot of things we do when you don't exercise where you say, gee, I wish I had done better. And I think the way to solve that problem is for people to be more disciplined. Now, it's hard. Most of us aren't more disciplined. I'll give you another example I think most of us have trouble with is checking our email. I check my email too much. So one of the things I did, because it's fun, maybe something interesting came along, and it's delivered constantly. It's not like the regular mail that comes once a day. It used to come twice a day. So what I did is I got rid of the phone that I had that allowed me to check my email easily, constantly during dinner or when I was at some activity like a kid's sports game or something like that, because I realized it was making my life a little more frenzied and a little less satisfying. But I kept doing it. So I sort of tied myself to the mast, as the expression goes, and I said, I'm not going to let this temptation get me. I'm going to take a radical change rather than just saying, oh, I'll just check it less. That's hard to do, so I just go cold turkey. And the way I do that with TV is I don't have cable. If I had cable TV, I'd watch a lot more, and so I just don't have cable. Now, it'd be a better world if I could just have cable and only watch it occasionally, but I think I'm not so good at that. I know that about myself, so I don't have cable. What I worry about is a world where the government says you can't have cable. Now, it's true that does reduce the amount of cable in the world, which has certain benefits for people who can't control themselves, but it has so many negative effects on the role of power of the government to do destructive things. When people can run other people's lives, it's very dangerous. That's number one. But the bigger point is if the government does it for you, it's treating you like a child. I mean, I do that to my kids. I don't let them have open access to the TV or the computer. They're kids. But I know when they grow up, they're going to have that open access. And part of being an adult is figuring out what those things are that you should be controlling and reducing and constraining yourself and disciplining yourself. To have it done from the outside is to treat us like children. So I think the way you make the world a better place is you figure out as a grown-up how to eat less and exercise more. And to have that imposed from the outside by a powerful central authority doesn't make the world a better place. It just forces you to do something that you don't want to do, and I think that's wrong. You might live longer. You might. I think you probably live shorter, because I think a government that does that starts doing other things too, and often that ends up in the gulag or the concentration camp. Most powerful governments do evil. There are very, very, very few examples of where a very powerful government was benign and benevolent. So I'm always going to worry about that, a source of danger. But even if it wasn't evil, even if it was benign and benevolent and it was able to do, quote, in my interest, I think that's the wrong way to perfect human beings. Having said that, human beings are not perfectible. It's a struggle, and that's what gives life a lot of its flavor, is that tension and trying to do the right thing. And I think that's a glorious thing about life. I wouldn't want it to be easy to eat less and exercise more.
If only they could make a Big Mac and fries that were actually good for you, and the more you ate, the better off you'd be, then that would be my dream world.
Well, they're working on it, I guarantee you. It'd be a profitable opportunity.
Oh, we are just about out of time. Actually, you're out of time. I've got all day, and I could listen to you all day long, but I'm going to have to wrap it up here. I've got one more question.
Okay.
Russ, as an economist and host of Econ Talk, the best podcast on the planet, where do you think the stock market's headed?
Well, you know, I have no idea. People ask me that all the time. I got asked just a couple days ago by someone I hadn't talked to in a long time. I said, so what's the Fed going to do? And I said, well, I don't have the faintest idea. And if I did, I'd be really rich, and I wouldn't be talking to you probably.
Right,
I'd be doing something
else.
So I don't know where the stock market's going, although I do feel in the next 50 years it's going to be higher than it is now. So I'm an optimist in the long run, but it's just in the case of my optimism of our political system, I have no idea where it's going tomorrow.
My guest today has been Russell Roberts of George Mason University and Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Russ, I wish you increasing success on your podcast and on your endeavors. I certainly encourage everyone to subscribe to your show. It is brilliant. Thank you for being my guest on the Mad Money Machine today.
Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun.
And thank you, listener, for joining me at the Mad Money Machine. I'll see you next week. In the meantime, visit our sponsor, Index Funds Advisors, at IFA.com. Email me at feedback@madmoneymachine.com or call the voicemail line 206-734-4763.